an intimate memoir about growing up Muslim in America after 9/11. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We're always live at 9 and never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime or on iTunes or stream us live right now on our Facebook page. Just ahead, a conversation with author Haroon Mogal about his book, How to Be a Muslim. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, retired NATO commander Admiral James Stavridis, plus Cole Pepper as the Sharks' winning streak comes to an end. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, more tragedy in London is being reported overnight after a van plowed into a group of Muslim worshippers leaving prayers at a pair of North London mosques. This happened very early this morning, leaving one person dead and injuring 10 others. Witnesses said the driver of the vehicle was heard shouting that he wanted to kill Muslims. It's the third such terrorist attack in London in just 3 months. Meanwhile, in this country, over the weekend, police found remains thought to be those of a missing Virginia teenager who they say was assaulted and disappeared overnight after leaving a mosque in her neighborhood. A 22-year-old man has been charged with murder in connection with that case, and police say they are investigating it as a hate crime. These crimes all occurring during the month-long Muslim celebration of Ramadan. And against this backdrop, we welcome a noted author who's long been accustomed to serving as a sort of Muslim explainer for Americans. Haroon Mogal was just another undergraduate student in New York when the September 11th attacks turned him into America's Muslim explainer. As the president of NYU's Islamic Center, Mogal suddenly found himself on TV, in print, and on the airwaves, talking about issues of faith and terrorism. Now, little did the national media know at the time that Mogal had lived with religious doubt bordering on atheism for most of his adult life. His struggles to live as a Muslim man in this country form the basis of his intimate and fascinating new memoir, How to Be a Muslim. Haroon Mogal joins us now in studio. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And the number to join the show is 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can weigh in on our Facebook page right now, too, where we're streaming this conversation live. And as I said, you were just another student in New York when 9/11 happened, and this role of Muslim explainer was sort of thrust upon you, correct?
Yeah, and if anyone watches the news, if you pay close attention, it's an interesting exercise to see how often we talk about Islam. I remember one of the statistics that I found so troubling and fascinating at the same time was that the greatest predictor of whether or not someone voted for Trump or Clinton was whether they thought Obama was a Muslim. And it's flattering in a disturbing way when your religious identity is granted that much power, but it's also crushing.
Because it really wasn't an identity you embraced, right?
It was an identity I embraced. I was very active in the Muslim community, but I was certainly not ready for the national stage. I was a 21-year-old kid whose primary concern was having a girlfriend and graduating from college and being part of a small community. My horizons were about 100 or 150 people. They were not the clash of civilizations.
Can you explain why all of a sudden after September 11th, you were the person that all of the networks in New York were calling on to go on television and give your thoughts about all of this?
For one thing, I was leader of the community that was closest in proximity to Ground Zero. We were one of the few communities that had actually gone out of its way to try to be more engaged with the wider public. And this is a problem that continues to afflict Muslims today, is that there are very few people who are competent at being in the public spotlight. And it was even worse that being a 21-year-old, I was still one of the few people who was able to handle that situation.
It's 549-2937 as we speak with author Haroon Mogal about his new well-reviewed memoir. It's called How to Be a Muslim. And, you know, at the top of the show, I mentioned the latest headlines that involve issues of extremism, terrorism, both abroad and here in this country. And I know that, as you write about in the book, this is something you deal with all the time. You're often called upon to react to these as though you, Haroon Mogal, speak for 1.2 billion people, which I would think it's an unfair thing to put on someone. And I think it would be a strange situation to put on someone. I'm not asked to comment on the actions of all white blonde women in America every time I step outside my door. But that's the situation you're often put in.
I could use it if I was a little bit savvier, because it would definitely increase my profile if I said I speak for 1.2 billion people. Suddenly I would be a tremendously powerful
that's
individual.
That's right. You'd be extremely powerful.
So possibly I should change my Twitter profile from occasional CNN commentator to leader of 20% of humanity.
That's right. Yeah, that would be good, a good career move for you.
And if anyone challenged me, I would just immediately excommunicate them.
But all kidding aside, I think that there's so much misunderstanding about Muslims in the West that people look to guys like you. And locally in Jacksonville, often the media asks UNF's Parvez Ahmed to sort of fulfill that role. In your book, you try to, it's a much more personal book. It's not really about politics. It's not about terrorism. It's more a personal look at your journey, sounds like.
There's a lot of books about Islam, terrorism, foreign policy, national security, and there are some very good books. But there are very few books that get to the actual experience of what it's like to be a Muslim in America. And obviously, my story is not everyone's story, although I do speak for 1.2 billion people. But it is the case that it is a story that is repeated very often. And it's a very human story. It's a very American story about coming of age and trying to figure yourself out and your place in the world and dealing with heartache and heartbreak.
You grew up in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
You grew up the son of two Pakistani Americans, both doctors.
Yes.
Both religiously devout.
Yes.
And what are some of the experiences particular to that that you think really formed you to write the book? And you also write about your bipolar disorder, by the way.
Yeah. My parents both immigrated to the United States in the early 70s. They actually came via the United Kingdom. And it's so interesting to think about what that experience must have been like, because they left Pakistan and arrived in the West when there was no satellite television, there was no internet, there was no easy phone connection. You were basically making a very clean break. And I can only imagine how overwhelming and challenging that must have been.
And why did they decide to come?
For the opportunity.
Just for the opportunity.
For the opportunity. My parents are doctors, and they believe that we would have a better life in the United States. And I can say that we do. Of course, the change in my father's circumstances compared to mine is almost hard to stomach. And it tells you something about Pakistani parents, that my father grew up not knowing what day he was born, because his mother was illiterate. So he just has a vague sense of how old he is. And I, his son, was expected to compete with the United States president. My father still asked me why my book takes so long to get published and Bill Clinton's was published so quickly.
Especially since you speak for 1.2 billion people.
I actually have more power than Bill Clinton. It's just, it hasn't been recognized yet.
Okay, 549-2937. So you have this upbringing in Massachusetts. You come to New York and you realize that you need to form a group for young Muslim Americans like yourself. And it took a different tone than some of the more traditional groups.
We tried to create a community that was as inclusive as possible. We realized that there were this large number of Muslims on campus, and most of them were completely disconnected from the community as it existed, because it was so parochial and it was so insular. So we went out of our way to try to welcome people from different backgrounds and different levels of faith. And we were very successful in that. And so when my senior year started, we were looking forward to turning the student organization into a campus institution with a fundraising drive and all of those things. And the first Tuesday of the semester was 9/11.
Describe that day for me, your day, that day.
I woke up very early because I had a crush on one of the students in my class. So I would try to arrive as early as possible so I could have the seat next to her. And when I came out of the subway, I noticed New Yorkers congregating on the sidewalk and staring up with their heads at a crooked angle. And normally New Yorkers do not stand on the street. They just rush across traffic as fast as they can. And that's when I noticed that the first tower was on fire. And I asked someone what had happened. He told me that a plane flew into the tower, which I interpreted, and I'm sure many people did at the time, as an accident. A terrible accident, but an accident. I certainly had no idea what kind of plane it was, that it was a passenger plane. I assumed it was a private plane. Went to class, and a student named Pasha came downstairs about half an hour later and said the second tower had been hit. And I remember the chain of events in my head, the thoughts linking one after another, that this wasn't an accident, that this was a terrorist attack, that it was probably Al-Qaeda, because who else could or would do it, and that I was president of the Islamic Center at NYU. And I didn't fully know how much my life would change, but I had a pretty good sense of it. But underlying all of that was fear. I mean, we had just been attacked, and we were all in New York, and we had no idea if this was the only attack, if there were more attacks. And one of the main cell towers in New York City was on the World Trade Center, so we had no cell phone service either. And at that point, rumors were flying, and we had been told that jetliners were attacking cities all across the country. So it was a particularly terrifying time, one, simply to be in the middle of a city that was under attack, and then to feel like you might be attacked because of that attack. So it felt a little bit like you were being pushed from both sides.
You felt afraid for your own safety, as a lot of people did in New York, but you also felt that perhaps being Pakistani and Muslim, that you could be vulnerable that way?
That people would be angry and they'd be looking for someone to lash out at, and maybe it would be someone who is visibly Muslim or foreign. And this is a common theme that people have. You mentioned at the top of the segment, the attack in London. These are not unusual attacks. We've started to pay attention to them more often. But there have been a number of remarkably violent plots against mosques in the United States in the last few years, including attempts at creating radioactive weapons. And these almost never get reported in the news. Fortunately, they're broken up or they fail to be carried through. Although I now wonder if we've now reached a point where they are actually happening. But we've been living with this fear for a very long time, that there's a lot of hate simmering under the surface. There's a lot of anger and misunderstanding, and it's going to break through at some point.
And your book, How to Be a Muslim, in the context of all this, it's not a how-to guide necessarily, but it really is. There is some advice and some insight in this book for other Muslim Americans like yourself.
There's going to be a lot of parents who are going to buy this for their kids and be deeply disappointed, because they're going to think this is going to tell their teenage daughter or son how to be the perfect child. And it's probably not what you want to give your teenage daughter or son if you're looking for the cookie cutter thing. So my main advice is, if you do fall apart, I have some ideas on how you can put your life back together again.
Because that happened to you too.
It did. It did in my early 30s.
We'll talk about that in a minute. But right now, let's go to a few of your calls for author Haroon Mogal. He was going to speak over the weekend at Jacksonville's Atlantic Institute, but his plane ran into some weather. We're lucky, though, to still have him on the show this morning. It's 549-2937. James is along Beach Boulevard. Hey, James. Good morning.
Good morning. I want to thank him and you for having a quality program like this. And also, I hope he stays on his medications for bipolar, bless his heart. It's a blood test, too. So my question is, I noticed that so many Americans today are fearful of their lack of understanding of Sharia. You and I know that it's not directly out of the Quran, but that it grows out of legitimate assumptions of the Quran, and yet there are those who feel that, mistakenly I believe, that it's required that you, quote, kill the infidel. What is that, chapter 9? I can't remember. But anyway, these are the fears that Americans have, their misunderstanding of Sharia, which parts are absolutely compulsory to be a good Muslim, and which parts are matters of interpretation by the various sects of Islam. If you will address that, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, James.
James has a great question, and it's a very big question. So I will say, I will answer it obliquely on behalf of 1.2 billion people on whose, and I have their authority to speak. They actually all gave it to me yesterday at a meeting. Barack Obama was there too. He's finally starting to be comfortable with himself. In all seriousness, and maybe this is a different way of answering it, you know, I grew up in a very religious household, and actually my mother's family, they were religious scholars going back many generations, and it was a pretty onerous legacy to inherit. But all the same, I did. A lot of the questions that people ask and these themes that extremists push forward were never raised. And my parents were extremely learned in the tradition. I mean, my grandfather, his father spoke Arabic, they spoke Persian, they wrote books, they were judges in British India, they applied Sharia and interpretations of Sharia on a regular basis. So they were as close to this as possible. And they would have never recognized what extremists peddle or what some of the tropes are. And my parents never raised me with any of these concepts. Like, I don't think anyone ever talked about enforcing Sharia. that concept only occurred to me and came to my attention well into my 20s when I started studying political Islam and being asked these questions. And for a lot of American Muslims, what's so overwhelming is that we are deprived of our humanity, we are robbed of our Americanness, and we are turned into caricatures of extremists from abroad, as if we're not human beings who exhibit the exact same diversity that any religious community would. That you can find Christians and Jews who run the gamut from extremely liberal to extremely conservative, and even those who are conservative are still human beings who are passionately dedicated to their communities. It's not like because someone becomes religious, they suddenly become some kind of automaton. And what's deeply hurtful for a lot of us is that we are reduced to this one-dimensional thing, which is a negative thing. And in the process, we become crushed.
And that happened to you?
And that happened to me, because my entire life became not how do I engage my religion and live out my religion and learn my religion and use it to become a better person, but how do I respond and how do I apologize and how do I answer and what if I'm not doing enough and I have to do more? And you drive yourself mad almost.
You flirted with atheism for a time.
I did.
You sort of rejected your parents' religion. A lot of kids do that.
Yeah.
Well, from a lot of faiths. And then at a certain point, you sort of circled back to it. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And in the middle of all this, you dealt with bipolar disorder, even a suicide attempt.
Yeah. And, you know, I can't say that one thing caused the other. Of course, I don't think anyone can tease out their life that easily, but it certainly wasn't helpful that at the same time I was disintegrating mentally. I felt this intense obligation to do more for my community and my country. And because of the great need, I think I broke myself because I pushed myself
too hard. How did you put yourself back together?
Well, then for that, you have to read the book because it's very valuable advice, and it's such a good book that the more people buy it, the less likely I will be to fall apart. Not trying to guilt trip anyone, but that's a very Pakistani strategy for child rearing.
So your parents are basically like everybody's parents. They just heaped a lot of guilt and expectations upon you, it sounds like.
A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. When you're asked why Bill Clinton's book gets published so quickly and yours doesn't, there's only a mild level of pressure.
All right. Let's go to some more calls for Haroon Mogul. His new book is called How to Be a Muslim. Sarah is in Jacksonville. Hey, Sarah. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I just have a comment, not a question. And he was right. There is a lot of hatred regarding Islam, but there are some of us out there, like myself, that hate all of it. Islam is not compatible with American values. Really, neither is Christianity or Judaism, not as the founding fathers set that up. It was very egalitarian, and that stuff is repressive, dangerous, and bad.
Thanks, Sarah. Okay, the idea that religious fundamentalism is just not compatible with our modern pluralistic society. Your thoughts?
America wouldn't be America without people like Martin Luther King Jr. and Muhammad Ali. There are interpretations of religion that are incompatible with American values, but there are interpretations of America that are incompatible with religious values. And some of the most remarkable change we've seen in this country and some of the greatest leaps forward have been by people of faith. That doesn't mean that we're a religious country, we're a secular country. But we are a country that values people's contributions no matter what their personal beliefs are.
What are your personal beliefs today?
I am a Muslim who is looking for a community he would like to belong to.
Don't feel you have one?
No, I don't. And I think that surprises a lot of people. They assume that I'm deeply plugged into religious spaces or communities. And actually, I work for the Shalom Hartman Institute now, so I do a lot of work in Muslim-Jewish relations. And I think in some senses that's become my passion, is finding ways to bridge communities where you have very like-minded people who perhaps otherwise would never talk to each other.
Hmm. Lydia on the north side. Hi, Lydia. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. First, Haroon, I love your name. I think it's beautiful.
Thank you.
And I wanted to let you know that I was raised in a Baptist household as a Christian. I now call myself a Christ follower, not a Christian, because I believe it's gotten a bad rap. But I want to apologize to you for Christians that are mean to you and are unkind, because that is not of any faith. God created faith, and we're to be kind to each other. And I just want to apologize to you for anything that is said to you meanly in the spirit of being called somebody calling themselves a Christian. And I applaud you for standing up for your beliefs. And also, being a Southerner, as is often the case, mental illness runs in my family also, and I'm very proud of you for medicating and controlling and owning it and saying it's okay to do this be wrong with you because it can be worked on and fixed and we're okay. And I just thank you for your courage.
Thank you for the beautiful message.
Thanks, Lydia.
That means a lot. Thank you very much. Be blessed.
Margaret in San Marco. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. We hear a lot about the intense enmity between Sunni and Shiite Muslims in some of the conflict zones in the Middle East and other foreign areas. How much is that an issue in the United States and in Western Europe and in areas where there's more of a developed area? And also, maybe in connection with that, is the Sufi tradition in any way an influence here that mitigates that, or how much of that is an influence?
A lot of the Sunni-Shia tension that we're seeing right now in the world is being driven by a conflict between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic of Iran. These two countries basically do not get along, and both lack adult leadership that is capable of having a mature conversation, and they've decided between themselves basically that they would rather burn half of the Middle East to the ground than have a civil relationship with each other. And the toxicity they're spreading is unfortunately contagious in a lot of the Middle East and in other parts of the Muslim world. Fortunately for communities like in the United States, we're pretty insulated from that because these countries don't have a particularly degree of influence in American Muslim communities. And I think unfortunately that's a misimpression. Most American Muslims are pretty checked out of politics in the Middle East. And I think like a lot of Americans, probably checked out of politics in general. So fortunately, I haven't seen much of it. I have seen a little bit of it here and there and some of that tension. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we are far away and we're not caught up in the middle of that.
Omar in Riverside. Hey, Omar. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Well, I grew up, I'm a first-generation American, African-American Muslim. I grew up in a Sunni community. I went to the Islamic Center of Talking Florida, Muslim schools. My parents converted back in the 70s. So I kind of have I guess a more American perspective because to me, although I grew up very Muslim and very traditionally and learned Quran and read Arabic and did all these things that, you know, a good Muslim boy is supposed to do, you kind of, as an American, really kind of post 9/11, you almost kind of retreat into the Americanness because I have the luxury of being able to do that. So, you know, a lot of it to me growing up, I understood the cultural aspects of some of the, you know, I guess interpretations of Sharia law. And growing up around a pretty large Pakistani community and Afghanis, and, you know, you had a lot of different people who had a lot of different interpretations of Islam and also how to interpret Sharia law. So a lot of it for me, you know, like you mentioned earlier, it was never a point where you thought that that was something that would be governed or that you would be governed by this ancient law that really had no relevance in today's world, whether it's here or, you know, overseas. So I really, you know, I'm on the way to work, so I'm rushing, but I'm glad that he's on, and I'm really interested to read the book and learn his perspective. You know, I really applaud him for speaking up and being one of the new generations of Muslim Americans that can give a really insightful perspective. So thank you.
Thank you,
Omar.
Thank you.
All right, we're getting some tweets and emails for Haroon Magul as well. Here's one from Twitter. What was your inflection point like going from a non-believer to believing in Islam?
The thing that brought me back to Islam is actually was Catholicism.
Catholicism,
yeah.
They don't know anything about guilt and expectations.
Nothing, not at all. None whatsoever. I'm being told this by the Pope right now. He and I have a back channel because
yes.
You know, as leader of the world Muslim community,
well,
understandably,
you'd have that,
we have a meeting every few weeks. We just kind of hang out and we watch Game of Thrones. So he's a nice guy.
He seems nice.
He seems like a really cool guy.
He seems cool.
I grew up in New England, and New England has you know, a lot of Catholic communities. And I remember I kind of decided not to believe in God because I wanted to have fun and be a common teenager. And I remember the first time I went to my girlfriend's house, she was Catholic, Italian Catholic. And, you know, my parents had taught me that religious people don't drink and don't date. And her family was totally fine with her dating me. And that was the first time that it occurred to me that that belief in God and religion can be two different things, that you can be a religious person but not be one type of person, that there were different types of yeah. religion and religiosity there. And so the thing that got me interested in religion again was actually being around really, really devout Catholics.
And here's a question for you from a listener. He emails the show. Here's the problem. We have millions who believe that the Quran and Sharia commands believers to kill Muslims who don't believe. Women, their testimony is worth a fraction of a man's word. Gays are to be killed, and so on. It is unfortunate that it is only Muslim countries in the world that have these penalties in their laws. What would you say to listeners like that who that their concerns about the extremism that we see expressed in some Muslim majority countries?
I have the same concerns. I mean, this I have family in Pakistan. Almost all of my family is in Pakistan. These extremist groups kill large numbers of Muslims. They find
and that, by the way, that's what gets lost in America.
Yeah,
that more Muslims have died at the hands of these extremists than Americans.
And incidentally, in the United States, you're more likely to be killed because someone thinks you're Muslim than killed by a Muslim.
Yeah,
which is an interesting reflection on where we are. But extremism is real, and it's a problem. And I know there are some Muslims who put their head in the sand and pretend it has nothing to do with religion. But the listener is exactly correct that there are large numbers of people who think that their behavior is validated by religion, and that makes them in many ways more dangerous. One of my hopes in writing this book was to reclaim a space for a kind of religion that's serious and that's creative and that's intense, but that is very dedicated to pluralism.
Well, I applaud you, and it's fascinating to have you on the show. We're lucky to have you this morning since weather did cancel your event in Jacksonville over the weekend. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
He's author and educator Haroon Mogul. His new book is called How to Be a Muslim. Much more still ahead later, Cole Pepper, as the Sharks' winning streak comes to an end. But up next, retired NATO commander and author James Stavridis, why sea power determines world power. His insights next.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
WJCT's Great Auction is where you'll find over 300 items, most starting at a fraction of their value, at auction.wjct.org. Packages include lodging, attractions, dining, recreation, beauty, and more. Bid now. The auction continues through June 26th at 8 p.m. Log on to auction.wjct.org for more information.
Join us as we celebrate a musical legacy that began more than a century ago. Blues Horizon, for the best in classic and modern blues, every Monday night at 11 p.m., only on 89.9 FM.
Welcome back. Well, since the time of the Greeks and the Persians clashing in the Mediterranean, sea power has determined world power. And no one understands this more than Admiral James Stavridis, one of the most decorated naval officers of our time. A retired four-star admiral with 35 years of active service in the Navy, Stavridis served as the Supreme Allied Commander for Global Operations at NATO from 2009 to 2013. In his new book, Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans, Stavridis takes us on a tour of the world's most important bodies of water and shows us how the geography of the oceans has shaped the destiny of nations. We're so pleased to have Admiral James Stavridis on the line. Admiral, welcome to the show.
Melissa, great to be with you. And by the way, for your listeners, please know that Atlantic Beach, Florida is my hometown.
That's right.
My in-laws Yeah, they're right there in Fleet Landing, and I'm in and out of Jacksonville half a dozen times a year anyway, so always great to be talking to folks on the First Coast.
It's great to have you, and I was aware of the Atlantic Beach connection and that you'd spent quite a bit of time there, so very cool to have you with us. And in fact, your connection to Atlantic Beach as a Navy guy comes by you so honestly. Is it true that you've calculated you've spent more than a decade of your 60-whatever years actually on the ocean, out of sight of land?
I have. And in the book Sea Power, I talk about how those days accumulated over years of time on various ships. But if you add them all together, it's right around 11 years. A lot of it going in and out of Mayport, where I served on a number of different ships.
And so you're perfectly poised then to take a really holistic view of the importance of our oceans, looking at everything from geopolitics to trade to environmental issues. Let's begin with trade. 95% of global trade, as you write, moves by sea. You want the U.S. to position itself more as a maritime nation.
Indeed. We ought to think of ourselves in many ways, Melissa, as an island nation, even though we're massive. But we have huge oceans on both of our Atlantic and Pacific coasts. We have a large Arctic Ocean to the north. And, of course, we have very benign neighbors north and south. So those oceans buffer and protect us. But if we isolate ourselves and don't invest in sea power, I assure you nations like Russia and China will rise up to fill that vacuum geopolitically. That's why the oceans are such an important part of our global alliance structure and such a part of American sea power.
You were considered, it's my understanding, for posts both in the Clinton and Trump administrations.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts then about the Trump administration's withdrawal from the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
I think it's a very bad decision. We are ceding an enormous geopolitical advantage, let alone the trade advantages, which we can debate those, I think, somewhat. But the geopolitics of simply pulling out of that treaty is roughly like the United Kingdom pulling out of the European Union, walking away after Brexit. It allows a vacuum. China will rise. And by the way, Melissa, China is claiming the entire South China Sea as territorial sea. This would be like the United States claiming the entire Gulf of Mexico as internal waters of the United States. If we allow that to happen, and walking away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership kind of opens that door, then China will be in a position to control that Asian trade and exert extreme influence on our allies. The Chinese are playing a long game, and they're doing it at sea. We need to be mindful, and we need to push back. To do that, we need a capable maritime force.
And you see that maritime force being watchful of both China, Russia, and then other dangers. For example, ISIS invading Europe through the Mediterranean southern border. Just a number of issues that fall under your concern here.
Indeed. And often I'm asked, well, you know, what good is a Navy against a bunch of terrorists? Well, let me give you a few examples. You may have seen just yesterday a Syrian jet shot down. That was shot down by a Navy fighter operating off an aircraft carrier in the eastern Mediterranean. Those SEALs, the iconic special forces, those are all Navy personnel, officers and sailors. Our Marines are taken to battle on our amphibious ships. That's how they get to places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, to close in on all of those terrorists. And lastly, the ability to control that Mediterranean Sea, where these waves of refugees are moving, and to police that and ensure that jihadists are not part of that slipstream of humanity, that's a naval function. So there are many, many reasons our Navy is not only important against big countries like Russia and China geopolitically, but also against the Islamic State, for example, in the world of terrorism.
In fact, you believe that the U.S. should beef up its fleet in the Mediterranean.
I think we should beef up our fleet generally.
Generally.
Let's just do the numbers. Yes, in the Cold War, we had close to 1,000 ships. Under President Reagan, we had close to 600 ships. Today, we're down to 275 ships. Every responsible observer, analyst, security expert will tell you, minimum, given our global footprint, we need 350 ships. So we've got to rebuild the fleet, and unfortunately, Russia and China are both building new, strong, capable fleets. China has aircraft carriers. Russia, excellent submarines. Russia will add 100 warships to its fleet over the next 3 years. We better wake up or we're going to find ourselves competing on the high seas. We don't want to compete on the high seas. We want to dominate.
And how do you see the current administration's shifting position on the NATO alliance as a retired NATO commander? And how all of these pieces work together through the framework of the NATO alliance?
Indeed. Well, a year ago, I was very, very concerned about statements coming from the Trump campaign. NATO is obsolete. We may not defend our NATO allies. Why are we involved in NATO to begin with? A lot of really harsh rhetoric. I spent over an hour with President Trump in December, and I found his position shifting at that time. More recently, just a few weeks ago, he attended the NATO summit. He gave a reasonable speech. He did not accept Article 5, but now he's turned on that as well. Article 5 is an attack on one is an attack on all. So point one, Melissa, the impression of the Trump campaign of NATO is changing for the better, I think led by people like General Jim Mattis, the defense secretary, who's also a former NATO official, as am I. And then secondly, I think the Trump administration sees the practicality of the capability of NATO, $300 billion budget. NATO's non-U.S. budget is the second largest in the world after the United States. So it's a good return on investment, and I think that light has gone on for the Trump administration. Let's hope it stays on.
And here's another interesting point that you make in your book. As a retired military guy, people might not think of you as talking a lot about environmental concerns, but in fact you do write about environmental degradation on the high seas, and also the threats posed by climate change to our warming oceans. What are your concerns there?
Yeah, I think if you want to take three issues that make the ocean so important, we've talked about two of them. One is the geopolitics and the alliances, and the second is the trade, 95% of world trade. The third key pillar is the fact that the oceans, Melissa, produce 70% of the oxygen we breathe. It comes from photosynthesis in the sea. And so if we pollute the oceans, if we acidify them, if we allow them to be overrun by huge fields of plastic, there's a field of plastic the size of Rhode Island in the center of the Pacific. Mm-hmm. If our fish stocks decline, all of that over time will present an enormous strategic risk, not only to the United States, but to the world. So I am a strong proponent of ensuring we do the right thing by climate. And I think that's another mistake of the Trump administration, is walking away from the Paris Accord, the so-called COP21 treaty, which was designed to get global warming under control. Big mistake.
There's much more in the book. It's Sea Power by retired NATO commander and Admiral James Stavridis of Atlantic Beach. Admiral, a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Melissa. Enjoyed it. Say hi to my hometown.
We sure will. And much more to come. We'll be right back.
Next time on 1A, how to repudiate the past. The Southern Baptist Convention is formally denouncing racism, including the so-called alt-right. It's a huge shift for a denomination whose founders believed God condoned slavery. What does this milestone tell us about race and religion in evangelical America? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Since the mid-20th century, Florida has been the launch site for America's space program. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Al Kohler, author of Exploring Space, Opening New Frontiers. We'll discuss the first comprehensive effort to map South Florida and talk about Jacksonville's Brooklyn Borough, first occupied by U.S. colored troops. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
How is Jacksonville spending our tax money? For years, city leaders have talked about bringing jobs and updating infrastructure to make the city more attractive. But are those investments spread across the city equally? Join our panel of experts and moderator Melissa Ross for a live, interactive, televised discussion on June 29th. To send your questions or to RSVP, go to wjct.org/events.
Welcome back. Well, it's a new campaign from Habitat for Humanity's local chapter, Habijax. The 2017 Women's Build is a way to provide struggling female head of household families in Jacksonville with a strong foundation, home ownership. Mary Kay O'Rourke is Habijax's CEO, and she's here with a preview of a big event coming up this week in Jacksonville, the Women's Build. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And this is going to be happening tomorrow. This is such a great idea because there are a lot of female head of households in this city.
There really are. And our population, the people that we serve, there's even more.
And tell us about who this is geared for.
Okay. This is geared for the build itself is we're focusing on women to participate, so even to get sponsorships to support the build of the home, and that would be companies that does with women leadership or companies that support women initiatives or their employees, and then also for the homeowners that we serve, and we serve about 82% of our clients are single female households.
82%.
Right.
And in Duval County, Habijax reports a single mom heads a full 25% of all households, with 21% of women living at the federal poverty level, and very often women with kids.
Yes. And most of our homeowners are right at that poverty level or a little bit above. And because we build homes and sell them for no profit with no interest, it's affordable. And it's an asset. So our homes with taxes and insurance is almost half of what the average rent is in Jacksonville.
Oh, really?
So
what will the house
affordable.
Payment be for the homeowners?
With taxes and insurance, it'll be just about $450 if it's a 30-year mortgage.
Amazing. Now, this is happening in the Newtown neighborhood. You're going to kick this off tomorrow on Hardy Street.
That's right. We have two lots together, so the two homes, because we're building two homes. The build will be in October, but we're announcing it tomorrow and having a kickoff. So we're excited. We have the home buyers already selected. One is a single mom with four children, and another is a single woman, a more mature woman who has adult children and a granddaughter.
And Habitat's model, a lot of people are familiar with it, but not everyone perhaps is. And I've participated in a Habijax build.
Mm-hmm.
You bring in skilled artisans and carpenters and regular people like me who don't know how to do anything, but try to help any way we can. I think I laid sod at one house. A bunch of my coworkers at WJCT, we all came out and worked on a house. But then you have the model in Habitat for Humanity of sweat equity, where the future homeowner does a lot of work on the house too.
Right. They're required to do 300 hours of sweat equity, and that's in the house or at our restore or also with workshops, because most of our homeowners are first-time home buyers. So there's a lot of workshops, first of all, financial workshops, but then what is meaning? What does it mean to own a home, the legal aspects, the maintenance aspect, the warranty aspects.
And how do you choose clients to become prospective home buyers through Habijax?
Well, there's three criteria, and obviously they are buying the home, so we do fund finance a mortgage for them. So the most important is their ability to repay the loan. So it's based on credit score and their income. And because it is a program for people in need, we serve 35 to 80% of the area median income, so it's low income. And then also their willingness to partner with us, you know, their willingness to do the sweat equity and accept some of the conditions that we have, where we have a first right of repurchase, and then also their need for a home.
And you're doing these two houses in the Newtown neighborhood, but of course, you'd like to do more. The more the community supports you, the more houses you can build.
That's right. That's right. So we've had women's build before, but it was only one. So we're being very aggressive this year and going to have two homes. And we're very excited about it. And tomorrow we'll be announcing our presenting sponsors. And then our we have honorary co-chairs. State Attorney Melissa Nelson will be a co-chair, as well as Assistant Chief Dolores Patterson from the JSO.
Very nice. It's the 2017 Women's Build, kicking off tomorrow in the Newtown neighborhood. Habajack CEO Mary Kay O'Rourke with the preview. Thanks for sharing it with us.
Okay, thanks for having me.
And in a moment, Culpepper.
Next time on The World, a religion for extremists, white extremists, that is.
A lot of these white supremacists believe that they're really under attack from immigrants, from ISIS, and that they need to sort of protect the white race.
And so they turn to a religion rooted in Northern European mythology, named for Odin, the Norse god of war. How Odinism is taking root in America. That plus the latest news on The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Vince Kong, host of Redux, WJCT's weekly news magazine and the news podcast of the First Coast. Tune in to catch up on the latest local stories, plus music from our after-hours programming, anytime, anywhere. Subscribe to WJCT Redux now on your favorite podcast app.
From jazz to indie music, listen to After Hours Monday through Friday at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. And finally, this hour, the Sharks' perfect season. Well, it didn't happen.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, the Jacksonville Sharks, playing in the inaugural year of the National Arena League, were undefeated through 11 of 12 regular season games. They had been dominating the league until Saturday, and that's when the Monterey Steel came to Jacksonville and beat the Sharks. Now, here's the interesting twist. Despite the loss, the same two teams will meet in the playoffs on Saturday at the arena at 7 p.m. The winner of that game plays the winner of the Lehigh Valley Steelhawks versus Columbus Lions game for the National Arena League Championship. So the perfect season won't happen for the Sharks, but the championship still may. It was a rough weekend for the Armada as well, trying to keep pace with first-place Miami. The Armada went to South Florida, lost 4-0. With four games to go in the spring season, it's now a long shot for the Armada to win the season and lock up a playoff spot. However, they will still have a good chance to make the postseason if they continue to play well. The first half and second half champions will advance, as well as the next two best overall records. And right now, the Armada stand in fourth place in the North American Soccer League with a home match on Saturday against Puerto Rico FC. For the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp, they finished the first half of the season with a sweep of the doubleheader against Pensacola. The Shrimp finished the first half with a record of 30-40. Four Jumbo Shrimp now on the South Division roster for the 2017 Southern League All-Star Game Tuesday in Pensacola. Jacksonville begins the second half with a five-game series in Jackson on Thursday and returns to the baseball grounds of Jacksonville a week from Wednesday against Mobile.
Okay, and in golf, we have a new champion at the U.S. Open, but not without a little controversy.
Yeah, it's the seventh consecutive major that there's a first-time winner. Kind of a remarkable run here. Brooks Koepka tied a record in winning the U.S. Open at Erin Hills, shooting a 16 under par. That matches Rory McIlroy's record for the best score to par in the U.S. Open. So far this year, Koepka has been one of the top players and finally broke through with a major this weekend. There has been some talk about it being too easy a course by U.S. Open standards. Usually, these are much more difficult. No less than former U.S. Open winner Johnny Miller said that the course is a little bit too light. We'll see what happens the next time around, or whether the USGA changes the way they set things up next year at the U.S. Open. Next up, as far as the majors are concerned, it's the British Open at Royal Birkdale starting July the 20th.
And what about the Gators and Seminoles both playing in Omaha?
Yeah, at the College World Series, Florida State made their road more difficult by losing their opener to LSU 5-4. This afternoon, they'll face Cal State Fullerton in a do-or-die game. The Seminoles will have to win four straight games to give themselves a chance to get out of the bracket and into the championship round. Not an easy task as Mike Martin tries to win his first ever national championship. On the other hand, the Gators started off their run in Omaha last night with a 3-0 win over TCU. Much easier to advance when you win your first game. Florida got a great pitching performance from Alex Fiedo. They move on to face Louisville in a winner's bracket game.
That's Cole Pepper. Follow him on Twitter and also check out the Sam and Cole podcast. Check on all the week's sports news and notes. Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. Never miss a show. Download our WJCT app. Listen there anytime or on iTunes. Next on 1A, the Southern Baptist Convention has officially denounced white nationalism. What this tells us about today's evangelicals. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.